Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, everyone. This is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Ricky Vellante, one of the co-founders of the Historical Basketball League. Ricky is also an attorney at Buckley King LPA in their Sports, Entertainment, and Media Practice Group, where he is primarily focused on legal issues related to professional and amateur sports, film and television, music, business formation and regulation, intellectual property, digital media, and the internet. In addition to his legal work and his efforts with the Historical Basketball League, Mr. Vellante also holds a number of teaching positions with educational institutions, including the Harvard Extension School, Cleveland Marshall College of Law, and the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. So it's good to have you here with us today, Mr. Vellante, to discuss the Historical Basketball League.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Peter.
Okay, and I gave a brief summary of your credentials. Is there anything else you want to talk about so we can better get to know you, some background?
Yeah, I mean, my entire professional career has been focused on issues, whether in legal or in business, related to sport and entertainment, as you pointed out. And so this has been sort of my life's work to date and something that I take very seriously.
Yeah, no, and one thing I've noticed in common with people on this podcast is people have a variety of experiences in their past. There's a lot of ways to get to being involved in sports, and you have a lot of experience there. So let's go ahead then and talk about our topic today. We're going to be talking about the Historical Basketball League. It's a league that you have co-founded along with Andy Schwartz, an economist who was previously featured on the Sports Law Biz podcast, as well as Bijan Bain. I think some of my listeners have never heard of this league, so could you give us a background and tell us why you guys came up with this idea and what exactly it's supposed to be?
Right. So the HBL is a proposed professional collegiate sports league that would consist of predominantly HBCUs, which are historical black colleges and universities, participating in the leagues in club sports. So these would be club basketball teams that would be participating in our league. The universities participating would be shareholders in the league, and we would essentially be putting to the test the idea that collegiate athletics require amateurism to be successful.
Okay, so this would be something outside of the current structure of college basketball as we know it. I mean, as far as intercollegiate, the NCAA or something like that, right?
That is correct. So our interpretation of this is that the conferences and the NCAA itself oversee varsity sports, whereas we would be positioning this as a club sport, thereby falling outside of their purview and their scope.
Okay. And these club teams, one big difference between this and the NCAA is that the schools themselves would be able to pay the teams, or somebody would be able to pay the players. How does that work?
Correct. So the schools themselves would not be paying our players. We would be functioning as a single entity employer where the HBL would be employing the players at each of the universities to participate on these club teams and participate in our league. The universities would still be providing the academic component, potentially providing academic scholarships. But the salaries themselves, which at the moment we've suggested will fall somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 per year, would be provided by the HBL itself.
Okay. And where would these players come from? You said these are club teams. You know, are these just rec teams that people that want to get paid $50,000 to $100,000 can just sign up and make some easy money?
No. So we would be targeting the elite high school basketball players that currently exist. So we would be going out to try to recruit the Ben Simmons of the world, you know, any of the players going to play for Calipari with Kentucky. We would be in the conversation or in that process as an alternative option where we currently see players now starting to go to China or other areas of Asia or going to Europe to get around the one and done and paid in some other platform than the NCAA. We would just be another alternative to that.
Okay, so then it's the same group of players that Kentucky or Duke or whoever would be targeting, but I guess the inducement would be that they could start getting paid while they're playing in college at this club team in this new league, rather than get the prestige that comes from being associated with Duke or North Carolina or Arizona or something like that.
Right. We are in the process of working with professional basketball players and former high-level collegiate players to create and build a package that would be attractive to those players and would appropriately incentivize them, as opposed to going to a more established program like Kentucky, instead come here. Another one of the components of what we're trying to accomplish is to have an open dialogue with the NBPA so that we're appropriately preparing these players for the NBA and not risking their future, their professional future. We would want to replicate everything that they get at Kentucky or Duke or North Carolina or University of Virginia, wherever the case might be, and also offer them the salary component, but soft and intangible benefits, you know, such as insurance, financial literacy and planning, things like that, so that they can begin to get that component, but then also have the opportunity to go after endorsements while they're in college. If it's a student athlete that knows that they're going to go to the HBL, they could even potentially start signing endorsements in high school and playing exclusively AAU until they arrived at the HBL.
Okay. It's separating the athletic component from the schooling component. Is that what it is? Would they still be provided scholarships, or is the thinking we'll give somebody $100,000, they can pay for their tuition with that, and then deal with it themselves?
So that's where the partnership with the universities themselves comes into play. The university would be providing the academic scholarship, assuming that the athlete qualified. We would be looking to have funds that would be dedicated towards scholarships such as that for our athletes, but then we would be providing the salary component. So it's that marriage of the two where we're handling the athletic side and the university is handling the academic side.
Okay. And because the money for the salaries would be coming from the league rather than from the university itself, the idea there is that it wouldn't be, you know, I think some people think, oh, if we pay the players, there's less total money in the pot to be able to give scholarships to other people, maybe to, you know, field hockey players or soccer players or something like that. Is that part of the idea behind that separation?
That is absolutely for a couple of reasons. We want the separation because we do not want to risk NCAA retribution on the other teams and sports on campus. You know, you run the risk of, if it's a varsity team, potentially getting into the area of lack of institutional control and thereby maybe getting a death penalty punishment from the NCAA, similar to SMU or some of the other programs that have received them over the years. So that is why we very carefully position this to be a club sport so that we're not risking any other athletes on campus.
Okay. And yeah, because I think, you know, hearing this idea, hearing, you know, it's an alternative to the NCAA, it's easy to see, given that the NCAA is involved in more than just men's basketball, how there could be ripple effects there and potentially, you know, even if it's a club sport and, you know, people in power at the NCAA or other places see it as an attack, that there might be some kind of, I don't know what the word is, punishment or retribution there. I guess that, just as an outsider looking at it, it seems like that is a big potential problem, that it's so big of a shift that the NCAA or member institutions are worrying about jeopardizing their relationships with TV contracts or the NCAA itself, and might be hesitant to join because of that, being the first one in. You know, is there any plan as far as how to address that hesitancy or to talk with these HBCUs?
So we actually did just present to a number of the HBCU presidents at the annual NFAO conference on August 1st. So we did get a chance to field some of the concerns and questions that they had, and that obviously was one of them. But we again, this is why we took the time to position it as club sports, because now, I mean, we obviously are not going into this looking for a lawsuit or anything like that to arise out of it. However, given the fact that we do have, you know, myself and others included that are attorneys, we wanted to position this in a way that if the NCAA or someone else did try to take that retributive action against this, we're so far outside of their scope and what they're permitted to do that it would be an antitrust violation at that point. So, and potentially a significant restraint of trade case would then be brought against the NCAA. So obviously that is not what we want to do. That's why we've positioned it the way we've positioned it, so that that isn't even an option on the horizon. But we feel comfortable with the way we're situating this, that if that arose, we would be at good odds to walk out clear and clean on the other side.
Right, and I don't imagine the NCAA would be looking for further antitrust litigation either, so that might be a check on that kind of situation as well.
Right, absolutely. I think their hands are plenty full with the Jenkins and other suits that are actively going on right now.
Right, okay. And you mentioned that you did this presentation to some leadership of HBCUs. What's the current status of the league? Is it still kind of embryonic, or have you started making positive steps towards implementing anything? Where is it right now?
Right, so this was a conceptual presentation for the most part. To your earlier point before we started here, not everybody knows this idea, and even the folks that do know this idea, you know, there are components of it that they maybe don't understand. So this was more an opportunity to have an open and clear Q&A session where we cleared up any ambiguities that there might have been or misunderstandings that there might have been. So really that's what that meeting was about, was more a conceptual standpoint. Where we're at in the process now is we're finalizing the financial projections and costs and revenues that we might see in this league. We're expecting to have that done by the end of August. At that point, the timing is obviously strategic. Kids are going to be back on campus. Football season is going to be beginning. You know, and in general, there will be a number of HBCU events in the sport context that then we can attend and begin to present this in a more professional, realistic manner at that point, whereby this is no longer a concept. This is a business plan. Here it is. Here are the benefits of being associated with it and moving forward pretty quickly throughout the fall.
Okay. So you're just gearing up then and expect it to start moving forward a lot.
Yes, I would say come September 1st, things are going to be shifting up several gears.
Okay, and you know, one question I think a lot of people might have is, as you're shifting up, you know, starting a league is not an easy endeavor. That's why, you know, we have a couple leagues in the United States, and they kind of stay that way or make gradual changes over time. What's the business plan for getting this done? It costs money, you know, you'll need to deal with TV and get places to play and things like that. Money's probably a big obstacle. What's the plan as far as getting funding for this league?
Yeah, so I guess I'll start off with the projected nest egg that we think we need. For the first 1 to 2 seasons, we have estimated somewhere between 30 and 60 million will be needed. And that's going to cover a range of things. That's going to cover salaries of the players, obviously. That's going to cover the coaches for our league, administrative costs, you know, to actually operate the league. But then more importantly, it's going to include facility upgrades for the venues and the campuses themselves so that they're adequately prepared to handle a national stream or broadcast for these games. So we are currently exploring private investor options. We've had a pretty overflow of really positive outreach thus far from a number of financial funds as well as individual investors who want to get involved at some level. So right now we're trying to figure out what's the best structure, because at the end of the day, we really want the largest benefit of this to go to the players and to the schools that are involved with us as shareholders. We don't want to fall into some of the same pitfalls that you could argue the NCAA has fallen into over the evolution of their system. So we're trying to figure out the best way in which we can get that money in the door, but not sign over the farm, so to speak, and mortgage the future so that we end up in a similar situation where the athletes and the schools aren't getting the most benefit here. Other opportunities, though, and to your point with the few professional leagues that have been successful in the U.S. and then, more importantly, the many that have failed over the last half century or so, all of them have to have a very strong either broadcast or streaming deal. That's the backbone of any one of these professional leagues. That's the largest source of revenue. So that is going to be a priority for us and will also play a role in the selection of what schools ultimately participate in this, because obviously we want to have large markets represented. So, you know, all of that is going to factor in. Other opportunity, you know, presenting sponsors, your apparel deal, jersey sponsors, you know, we would want to have what the NBA currently has, having those, you know, 2x2 patches that have corporate partners with each of our schools. So the pie is potentially very large there, but it's just a matter of realistically estimating all of that and then getting it into place.
Yeah, no, I mean, this vision that you guys have is really interesting. It's unique. You know, there's been lots of challenges to the NCAA structure and, you know, lots of different types of sporting leagues and organizations that have existed. But I think this one is really unique. And, you know, whenever you're starting something new, there's always a little bit of a chicken and an egg of trying to get people to sign on, you know, and to get schools. You need to be able to show that it's a viable league and, you know, and you have sponsorship, but the sponsors and things like that don't want to join until you have schools and things like that. So, you know, it's certainly a lot of work ahead, as I'm sure you're aware. Yeah, I mean, if this
the
is
struggle we're living every day right now.
Yeah, but I mean, if this is successful, it would be a big deal. I mean, it would be interesting to you know, I know I'd just turn in just to see kind of what a game between, you know, Howard and Morehouse would look like in this new league or something like that. So I think people would be interested in checking it out if it could get off the ground.
And, you know, the alumni base of these HBCUs is a lot stronger than some people realize. So, I mean, just starting with that as sort of your background or your backbone to your viewership, but then also now going to why certain leagues have been successful beyond just their television deal is the level of talent. And I think Americans prove over and over again, like just take the adoption of Premier League clubs in England, how that's kind of spread across the U.S. If there happens to be really elite talent playing a particular sport, Americans are going to tune in. It's just something we do. We love sports where we identify with it such a molecular level almost. It feels like that if we can start pulling in elite talent, people are going to tune in to check out Morehouse or Grambling or Howard or Clark or whomever to see what this is all about. And this is where I think once you get those viewers on board, seeing the culture and the passion and the atmosphere that exists already on these campuses without having the elite talent, I think will just blow the socks off of people. And they'll want to keep tuning in once they view that first game.
Okay, well, yeah, as we're getting ready to kind of wrap it up here, I think some people, some listeners of this podcast are probably familiar with Andy and his work in the O'Bannon case and other NCAA-related cases. And I think one question some people might have is whether this is really a real attempt to establish a league or if it's just kind of another way of thumbing a nose at the NCAA and saying, you know, you guys are living in the past or whatever. And so I guess, could you just let us know, is this something that you're seeing as a real viable option? Is it just kind of a flare that you're sending up? What's your vision for this league?
For me, this is very real. I think that Andy did a great job of bringing the right people in as he continued to develop this idea for that exact reason. I mean, he's very vocal in his anti-NCAA views. And he didn't want this to get lost in the noise of this is just Andy being Andy and going after the NCAA in a new way. He wanted to bring together a really strong group that clearly showed that this is a realistic option that we want to explore. I mean, me personally, again, going to my background, with my educational side, my legal side that I bring to the table, it doesn't necessarily benefit me to do something just for the sake of poking the NCAA in the eye. Yeah. I would have only jumped on board if I thought that this was something legitimate and would better the lives of these student athletes that currently are being disadvantaged in certain ways. And then when you look at the system that the HBCUs have kind of been defaulted into, you know, where they're being rendered ineligible for championship participation because of APR ratings and things like that, they're pretty hard done themselves. And I think it's an opportunity to reset the system. And then let's just see if amateurism is the magic sauce that makes everybody tune in or not.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because I think there is some validity to that argument that people like the idea of amateur athletes. People have strong ties to their schools that they're alumni of. But certainly, I think there's definitely a valid argument to people want to see the best level of basketball as well. So, you know, if you could attract people with salaries to these schools, I definitely think people would watch.
So. Yeah, I mean, the one statistic that always jumps out at me is 63%, I think this was as of 2014, 63% of scholarship Division I basketball players were African-American, and then it was 59 to 60% of all Division I football players that were scholarship were African-American. So, you know, they're being, in a lot of ways, they're the ones being really hard done by this system, because they're essentially paying for these universities to do whatever they want, whether it's build a new library or cover the costs of every other team on campus. And then you have players, I'm thinking of like Lattimore from South Carolina, whose knee gets shredded and then he never gets his opportunity in the league, despite the fact that his talent was so clear. And, you know, he's very hard done by the current system. So trying to right that, bring it back to being a more balanced situation. You know, we saw it in the professional context in the 70s and the 80s with the Oscar Robertson case, with the Curt Flood case, which obviously Curt didn't win, but it ended up working itself out in the Curt Flood Act and in the Messersmith-McNally arbitration. But all those resets that happened at the professional level, I think we could all agree that at some level that needs to happen now within amateurism or within the college model.
Okay, well, yeah, no, I mean, this is one of those steps, you know, like you said, in baseball, the big changes there, they didn't happen overnight. You know, there was the Flood case and all these other individual things that over time changed the financial success of the players in baseball. So yeah, this is an interesting step here. I know I'm interested in seeing how it goes. I wish you luck headed into September and everything. I'll definitely be paying attention. So we'll see how this goes. And, yeah, I don't know if there's anything else you want to say before we wrap up here.
Yeah, I mean, just that we are currently being considered for a South by Southwest panel. So if anybody wants to check that out, you can actually currently vote for us to be presenters at South by Southwest. We're also going to be presenting at the University of Texas in October, I believe, at their annual sports and media conference. So, you know, there's going to be continued updates as this progresses. So there will be ways for everybody to keep up to date as we keep going along.
Okay. Well, we will be paying attention. So thanks for coming on the Sports Lobbyist podcast today. And it's been great to talk with you, Ricky.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Peter. It was a pleasure.
This has been an episode of the Sports Lobbyist podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Lobbyist website, or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, for designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIB Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.